Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 424, recorded on Sunday, May 1st, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and filling in this week for Rachel is returning guest to the program, Patrick from the show Conspiracy You Can Believe In. Patrick, welcome back.
Hello, Bill.
So, Patrick, I know you've been periodically putting out some episodes on a whole range of different topics. For those who maybe missed your previous appearance, your show, Conspiracy You Can Believe In, tends to focus pretty heavily on straight up and down, legit, full out criminal conspiracies that we have pretty good evidence for. You know, obviously, you're not taking a position one way or the other on some other conspiracy theories, but these are ones that, like, we have pretty good evidence that, okay, there was a, you know, or at least relatively strong circumstantial evidence that there was some type of conspiracy. An interesting one that I liked that's not necessarily relevant to today's episode, but I wanted to just do a plug for, was your recent episode about the role that Texaco played, and specifically the head of Texaco, in not only supplying fuel for the Franco forces, the fascist, or however you want to call it, the anti-Republican forces in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, but also providing a pretty significant military intelligence effectively through their global shipping networks on, you know, supply convoys and things like that that were coming in for the Republican side. I definitely encourage people to check out that episode, learn more about the role of Texaco there. That was fully, you know, illegal conspiracy to do that. But more relevant, and I guess we'll get into this, you know, as we go, but maybe you can explain, you had done an episode about a criminal conspiracy involving the post-Reconstruction South and your home state of Alabama. What was, in short, what was the deal with that that episode that you did?
Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks. So the 1901 Constitution of Alabama, that was what that episode was about. And it really marks a point where, starting in the 1890s, this was long after Reconstruction had ended, but this was when Southern states were, they were able to figure out that they could get away with fully enshrining Jim Crow into state law. Mississippi, shortly before the Alabama 1901 Constitution, they passed their own state constitution that, without saying it explicitly, disenfranchised basically all African Americans in the state. And that's what the 1901 Alabama state constitution did. You can go and read the minutes of the meeting. They said this openly, like in the start of the convention, we are doing this to prevent black people from voting. And then when they actually, they carried it out by a referendum and they stuffed the ballot boxes. Like, it didn't actually pass. But through voter fraud and through just outright cheating, they enshrined the 1901 Alabama state constitution into law, which it is still the state constitution of Alabama today. And it's like one of those things I'm a sovereign citizen about. I don't recognize it. It's not real. I am a free man on the land. I don't recognize the authority of the 1901 Alabama state constitution. The only real state constitution of Alabama is the 1868 Reconstruction era constitution. That's what I choose to believe, and it is the worst constitution on the planet. It is certainly the longest one, and I think it should be struck down.
Yeah, they keep amending it endlessly because of how annoying it's set up and how little local control there is. So it's just incredibly long, in addition to being illegal, unconstitutional, and as they used to say, not a Republican form of government. The one reason that I'm bringing that up is, you know, you did an episode on that and then a companion piece talking about the broader sort of political landscape of Alabama at the turn of the last century, the very late 1890s, the early 1900s. But that's sort of, as you just alluded to, kind of a generation after the Reconstruction period, or at least the height of Reconstruction. And, you know, at that point, you've got sort of a new post-Civil War elite in place in the South, even post-Reconstruction elite in the South. And, you know, one interesting thing that I think I got a better handle on from listening to your episodes on that was that it was kind of a mixed picture, because you did have a bunch of former Unionist guys in the South who were still part of that political elite, and there were some ideological differences there on local and state issues, but broadly speaking, shared a lot of the same segregationist values. In some cases, there were some that were more pro-labor, but in many cases, just pretty blanket hostility toward organized labor across the board. And you really get into kind of the details of that particular dynamic. But I want to roll back the clock for this episode and talk about kind of how, you know, what is the precursor that gets us from the end of the Civil War in May of 1865 to this later generation. And to my mind, you know, not to say that this is all contingent upon this one thing, because as we're going to talk about, it really is not. This is kind of an inevitability in many ways. But one of the sort of key stepping stones as part of that process is this Amnesty Act of 1872 that we're going to be talking about today, which kind of helps unlock the door to some of that formation of the new post-Reconstruction political elite in the South. You know, the Unionist guys were already in the clear, but there were a bunch of ex-Confederates that get kind of brought back into the fold more officially. And that was something that I found kind of interesting and wanted to dive into. And the reason that we're timing it for now is that this was 150 years ago this month. So on May 22nd, 1872, was when this was became law. The Amnesty Act restored certain federal civil or civic rights, you might say, to ex-Confederates, at least those who had not already had their rights restored as early as May 1865 under Andrew Johnson's presidential Reconstruction period. And this Amnesty Act of May 1872 was signed into law by President Grant after two-thirds passage by both houses of Congress following the requirements of the 14th Amendment. So about 500 specific people, not that they were spelled out specifically by name, but by conditions, they were not included in this amnesty. This included prior federal office holders who had defected to the Confederacy in 1860 and 1861. These were not restored under the 1872 legislation on office holding amnesty. You might call these the elder statesmen of the South, in that they had been Southern politicians before the Civil War, and they still had to wait for a further round of amnesties before they could re-enter office. And they did actually, in many cases, re-enter office, which is sort of shocking to think about, although not surprising. But under the May 1872 amnesty, about 150,000 former Confederate troops finally had their restrictions lifted, and they were now clear to re-enter public life. And I would argue that many of them go on to form that new generation of a restored Southern ruling elite. In July 1872, following up on the May 1872 amnesty law, blanket pardons were issued to those who did not fall within those exception categories of the former federal office holders and so forth. And federal prosecutors dropped charges against anybody that wasn't within one of those exception categories in the May 1872 legislation. So again, one of the kind of questions to be thinking about if you're listening to this, and we're going to get into it a little bit as we go, is this question of, is this a turning point or is this a long foregone outcome? Maybe it's a combination of the two. I think that's kind of where I'm leaning, although definitely it seems like it was kind of an inevitability by the time that it happened, even though it didn't need to play out that way in the broader picture of Reconstruction. The Amnesty Act itself, it's extremely short. It reads as follows: be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, two-thirds of each house concurring therein, that all political disabilities imposed by the third section of the 14th Article of Amendments of the Constitution of the United States are hereby removed from all persons whomsoever, except senators and representatives of the 36th and 37th Congresses, officers in the judicial, military, and naval service of the United States, heads of departments, and foreign ministers of the United States. So basically, again, if you were involved in the Confederacy's government or military, and you didn't fall in one of these categories of having been like a former congressman or senator or something who defected, or, you know, a general or admiral or a foreign ambassador, as long as you weren't in those categories of defectors, you were now in the clear to have your 14th Amendment restrictions lifted. So as a refresher for the listeners, the 14th Amendment, which was adopted in 1868, the third section, which is the one that's relevant here, reads as follows. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such a disability. End quote. So this is the legislation in May of 1872, is that 2/3 vote by both chambers to remove that disability. And again, this was a pretty, you know, under the 14th Amendment, this is a pretty long list of people that get dinged by this requirement, right? Even if you were a state legislator and you went and supported the Confederacy after the outbreak of the war, you were now barred from holding office. And Patrick's about to get into how the office holding was distinguished from voting rights. But the point being here that now all of a sudden, all of these sort of political elites and everything, and even just rank and file Confederate soldiers, all of a sudden were now going to be eligible, unless they were in that very narrow list of continued exceptions, they were going to be eligible once again to hold office, both at the federal level and at the state level where they had previously been barred from serving. So Patrick, could you explain a little bit about what rights these guys did and didn't have in this period between the end of the Civil War and this May 1872 amnesty? What is the actual thing that is the political disability that's being lifted from them at this point?
Okay, so this is actually something that I learned myself while researching for this, because like a lot of people, I believed that these Confederates were restricted from voting, that disenfranchisement meant not being able to vote for a certain period of time. But there's an article from the historian James A. Rawley. This is from 1960. This is when the historiography of Reconstruction began to get a little more sympathetic to the plight of African Americans in the South and to the role of the federal government in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. He points out that the Amnesty Act really only restored the right to serve in office, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not restrict these people from voting. There was an attempt from Thaddeus Stevens, a really cool guy, radical Republican representative. He tried to write a section of the 14th Amendment to ban all former Confederates. So not just officers. This is anyone who even served in the military or aided and abetted the CSA. He tried to ban them from voting until 1870. But this was changed to Section 3 as we know it in the Senate, which upset Thaddeus Stevens, but he still supported the passage of the 14th Amendment. However, this gets a little complicated when you get to the state level. There were some southern states under biracial Reconstruction governments, such as my home state of Alabama, that did extend this federal ban on office holding to voting. So if you look at that 1868 Alabama state constitution that I was talking about, it simply said that, okay, all of those restrictions that the 14th Amendment puts on this class of people, we are also going to extend it to voting. And in Article 7 of the Alabama State Constitution from 1868, it calls out, quote, those who may be disqualified from holding office by the proposed amendment to the Constitution of the United States, known as Article 14. So what they were doing with this was saying, even before Article 14 passed, they were saying, okay, we're going to extend this ban on holding office to voting. But there were only a few southern states that actually did it. Alabama and I believe Louisiana. There may have been a couple others, but that was not a blanket across the board ban on voting. And even then, it often was not enforced. In 1868, a white unionist named William H. Smith, he was a Republican, became governor. You'd think he would be supportive of Reconstruction policies, but he supported re-enfranchising all of those people and giving them their right to vote back, and didn't really enforce taking it away.
I'm also guessing, and this is speculation on my part, but in those other states that did not extend that ban to voting rights, it probably creates some pretty perplexing and counterproductive incentives with these unionist politicians who are eligible to run for and serve in these offices, but they have to probably rely on, or at least incentivize to rely on, these ex-Confederates who can't hold office themselves but do have the right to vote. It's just something that I thought of that's an interesting result of having the two-tiered system. So you'd probably get a bunch of these unionist guys supporting more lenient policies than they might have otherwise, because this is a potential voting pool for them. Now, interestingly, there was that July 1872 pardon to end the prosecutions that were happening. And, you know, you might wonder, okay, well, why are there prosecutions happening? And it's because, and I'm guessing this is the other problem, is, you know, when you've barred that many people from holding office, even at the state level, you're probably having some difficulty finding people to fill certain offices, especially if it was in a, you know, an area that did not have a lot of black voters. I'm guessing they would probably, or potential office holders, you know, areas that had been not necessarily filled with unionist would-be politicians. I'm guessing there were people who were trying to run for office despite the provisions of the restrictions. But I don't know if you had seen anything on that as well.
I hadn't, but one of the things that I found throughout researching, for instance, for the episode that I did on the populists in Alabama in the 1890s, throughout Reconstruction and beyond, even if you were more of a liberal-minded Southerner or a white Southerner who was supportive of Reconstruction, you know, they called them scalawags or some, you know, names like that, white supremacy was a pretty effective wedge issue for white voters like this. So, for instance, William H. Smith, even though he was elected as a Republican, elected with the support of the black community in Alabama at the time, he ended up being pretty conservative, you know. Andrew Johnson is another example of this kind of politician. There were a lot of guys like that in the South at the time. They were unionists during the Civil War. They may have had some fiery rhetoric against the Confederacy when the war was happening and immediately after. They probably hated, you know, the planter class. But when it came down to the question of supporting civil and voting rights for black Southerners, they weren't going to go that far.
So let's talk about the timing of this. So May 1872, why was it then that this particular round of amnesty gets passed? So again, we know that there's going to be a later amnesty that really lifts all the restrictions. We know there's an earlier amnesty as well. Why do we get this sort of this particular tier and the timing on that? So for some very narrow background, the 1872 Amnesty Act was sponsored by Massachusetts Congressman Benjamin Butler. At the time, he was a radical Republican, but before the war, he had been a Democrat, and much later on, he was a Greenbacker and then once again a Democrat. And Butler had controversially served as the Union general in charge of the occupation of New Orleans, with a reputation that was partly deserved and partly hostile propaganda. In the immediate aftermath of the war, in early to mid-1865, he had provided legal advice and legal representation to the Andrew Johnson administration on several cases involving prosecution or potential prosecution of ex-Confederates, more for their treason activities. In those cases, he represented the hardline position, but like many of his fellow radical Republicans even at the time, by 1872, kind of coming around to a more softer position. So for some wider background, we can turn now to some of the books written on Reconstruction by Eric Foner, who's one of the leading scholars of this topic, particularly from, we should say, the perspective that Reconstruction was good and should have gone farther rather than that it was some sort of, you know, evil, nefarious thing. As always, you can check out the citations for this episode in a PDF that goes up with this episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com. But we're going to be talking mostly about Reconstruction America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1867. That was Eric Foner's big sort of masterwork in 1988. There's also an abridged version that I took a look at for some additional pieces of information that was published in 2005. And there were some other books that he's written on the topic as well, but did not end up using those for this particular narrow specific topic. So in the books, Foner essentially makes the case that although the amnesty idea had been floating around in Congress since the session of 1870, it finally got passed, when it did, as a deliberate national political response by Republican Party leaders to a liberal Republican, basically a defector category of Republicans, and Democratic Party's surprise joint nomination of newspaper publisher Horace Greeley for president in 1872 against the incumbent President Grant. Greeley had been a noted anti-slavery figure before the war, but he had also taken an extremely soft line on the Confederacy at the beginning and end of the war, and was now running on a platform of winding down Reconstruction, including political amnesty for former Confederate politicians, officers, and soldiers. However, his support within the Democratic Party was soft for a range of reasons, including that he wasn't really a Democrat per se, and had kind of been forced on them externally by circumstance as a unity opposition pick. And as well, he had some idiosyncratic views on issues that were pretty much unrelated to the Southern questions. So Republicans sensed an opportunity to signal a softer, less radical line on Reconstruction as well, and thus peel off some Democratic or swing constituencies to stick with Grant as the devil they knew. Greeley had been publicly arguing for, quote, universal amnesty and impartial suffrage for the ex-Confederates since the moment the war ended, saying that the failure to do so left out the, quote, best men from service as Southern leaders. He had been continuing for years to editorialize against the Reconstruction state governments and the lack of, his euphemistic term was, local self-rule. By passing the Amnesty Act in May 1872, Republicans took away one issue that he could campaign on against Grant. Its passage happened in the same flurry of legislation meant to steal his platform out from under him, such as a 10% tariff cut the same month. They also stripped down and then killed Charles Sumner's Radical Civil Rights Act bill to such an extent that he ended up voting against it when it came up for a vote. That unpassed bill in its final form also ended up providing, against his intent with the original version, the basis of subsequent separate but equal public spaces and facilities, and thus racial segregation enshrined in law. Sumner had hoped his bill could be passed as part of a package deal with amnesty, but only the amnesty ended up passing. Unfortunately, black supporters of the Republican Party felt they had no other option but to continue supporting Grant and the Republicans despite these rollbacks of Reconstruction efforts and failures to pursue civil rights. So, Patrick, one thing I'm noticing there is, like, even someone like Charles Sumner, whose credentials are really hard to question, I mean, he definitely made some mistakes, but in terms of his, you know, abolitionist credentials, his pro-black credentials, even he is kind of coming around by 1872 to saying, I guess we're going to have to do some amnesty. Let's see if we can try to get a better deal. He's unsuccessful in that effort. But that to me seems noteworthy in that question of whether or not this was kind of an inevitability by the time it actually arrived.
Yeah, and he ended up endorsing Horace Greeley for the 1872 election, didn't he?
Yes, that did not go over very well with a lot of his, you know, traditional supporters and allies.
Yeah, but it is notable that even someone like Charles Sumner or, you know, Benjamin Butler, who he started off as a pretty conservative Democrat, changed his politics during the course of the Civil War, but, you know, this was the guy that thought of the contraband of war policy, where basically you remove the ability of slave drivers to have what they see as their personal property. And that was a huge, I think, change in the war aims for the Union Army during the war. Benjamin Butler pushing amnesty is also pretty surprising to me. And then once you like read about the 1872 election and the people that were involved with the liberal Republican movement, it was a lot of Democrats, obviously, in opposition to Grant. But then a lot of these people who had really hardcore anti-slavery credentials before the Civil War, you know, people like Carl Schurz, who ended up becoming, I think, kind of wishy-washy on black civil rights and the right to vote during Reconstruction. But before that time, he was certainly known as like this big anti-slavery advocate. So I found that interesting that like Strange Bedfellows brought together with the 1872 election. It included a lot of people who, you know, were on the left wing of the Republican Party when Lincoln was alive, and, you know, coming into a coalition with, you know, the most reactionary Democrats. It's really interesting and weird.
And a lot of it, as we kind of alluded to a couple times, has to do with economic policies. We've actually done an episode on the show about kind of capitalism in the American South, especially in the period before and after the Civil War. You and I have on our own shows respectively done episodes about sort of the arrival of, like, you know, the rail industries in a big way, the mining industries and things like that, that really kind of changes the contours of the South. And so that in many ways, you know, how you shake out in the, you know, early 1870s on economic policy questions and your alignment toward capital versus the ordinary people, the workers, you know, and you even get, I think Foner talks about this, that if your focus is to turn plantation agriculture into sort of a proto, like, agribusiness, an industrialized farm production almost, you're going to suddenly start walking back a bunch of positions that you previously held about the liberation of these black workers on these plantations, because you're all of a sudden realizing, oh, actually, no, wait, we want those people to be kind of tied to the production of these agricultural goods and to not be, you know, smallholder farmers on 40 acres and so forth. And that, I think, contributes to a lot of this. I also get the sense, though, that there's just much earlier than the 1877 that often gets talked about in, you know, your high school history textbook or whatever, there, the enthusiasm for Reconstruction, even among some of its previously most ardent supporters, is really starting to run out of steam. The morale to keep up the effort is going down by 1872. I think that's a lot earlier than a lot of people who are only sort of casually familiar with the period would necessarily be aware of, especially because Grant becomes so closely associated with a lot of this Reconstruction enforcement efforts, and he goes on to serve a second term. So you kind of think, okay, well, so it must have been after that, right? You know, more towards the 1877 compromise period. But, you know, I think you were going to talk about some of the other things that kind of lead up to this period. And the sort of political turmoil around these questions of how far to really push this and to enforce it, that seems to suddenly start sapping the political will to keep fighting on this issue, even if, you know, you and I think they should have.
Right. So this would take us to the Enforcement Acts of 1870 and 1871. These were pieces of legislation passed almost immediately after the first one was passed, almost immediately after the 15th Amendment passed. But the Enforcement Acts were designed to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Remember, the 14th was the one that extended full citizenship to former slaves, and the 15th was the one that banned racial discrimination for voting. So on paper, these are pretty strong acts. The first Enforcement Act in 1870 criminalized preventing eligible voters from casting ballots. It outlawed voter intimidation, and it also outlawed disguised groups from going on public highways or on other people's property with the intent to intimidate people from the polls. So that was certainly something aimed at groups like the White League or the Klan. The second Enforcement Act was in 1871. And this one was much smaller than the first one. It just added provisions to the first Enforcement Act for federal supervisors to show up in areas where there was definitely some kind of election shenanigans going on. But then the third act, this was also in 1871. The third Enforcement Act is also known as the Ku Klux Act. And that made voter intimidation and conspiracy to overthrow the government or to prevent people from serving on juries a federal offense. It also empowered federal marshals to use posse comitatus to enforce it, and it empowered the president to use the military to enforce it. So on paper, especially this third act is really powerful. And initially, in 1870, 1871, the enforcement is going pretty good. In 1870, the U.S. won 74% of cases that year covered under the Enforcement Act. But starting in 1872, that number really dropped off. In 1872, the U.S. only won 41% of cases. And by 1874, this number dropped to 10% and lower of successfully prosecuted cases under the Enforcement Act. Now, this happened for a lot of different reasons, but one of the big ones is public opinion among Northern whites was really no longer supportive of a strong military-style protection of Black voting rights in the South. But just as important, former Confederates and their allies were actively resisting the Enforcement Acts and refusing to even recognize the 14th and 15th Amendments. Now, I found this passage from an article by the historian Everett Swinney called Enforcing the 15th Amendment. And he gives an example of one of the people who was charged under the Enforcement Act was a guy named Linton Stevens. Linton Stevens was a former Confederate officer. He was also the stepbrother of the CSA Vice President Alexander Stevens. And if you know your Civil War history, Alexander Stevens was a weird little guy, a horrible person. He was the guy that made the Cornerstone speech that was explicitly saying that the Confederacy was in the cause of protecting slavery. So Linton Stevens is his stepbrother. He is charged under the Enforcement Act, and he had this to say about the 14th and 15th Amendments. Quote, "These so-called amendments are not true amendments of that sacred instrument. They are nothing but usurpations and nullities, having no validity themselves, and therefore incapable of imparting any to the Enforcement Act or to any other act whatsoever." So basically, when a lot of people started to get charged under the Enforcement Act, they just refused to recognize the 14th Amendment. That was the tenor of the conversation in the South by 1872 and certainly 1874. And of course, there was just rampant violence against Black voters, people who attempted to serve on juries, Black people who attempted to run for office or even to serve as witnesses in these cases. There's one example in 1872. The district attorney of Northern Mississippi had a case completely fall apart because five key witnesses were murdered. So what you're seeing here is not just the Amnesty Act being a signal that Reconstruction is starting to become politically a little unpalatable among the white population, you know, former allies of Black Americans and freed slaves no longer having the stomach to do what I think they needed to do and fully enforce these laws. It was also just a violent uprising against these laws and against these amendments and the attempt to enforce it. That's why you saw a lot of Klan violence after 1872 and 1874, and that's why Reconstruction ultimately ended.
So one of the sort of big themes that I think most people, you know, who have a cursory or basic understanding of American political history in this period, they know that, you know, first you have the Reconstruction governments, then you have the Redeemer governments, which is this sort of reaction to that. But in order for that to really happen in a big, big way, you first have to allow all of these guys that are associated with the Confederacy, fought in the Confederacy's military and that kind of thing, re-enter public life completely by actually holding offices, put them in direct competition with these pro-Reconstruction state legislative and gubernatorial candidates and so forth. And that basically happens after this 1872 amnesty. Not to say, again, that this is like the decisive turning point, but it's definitely an important stepping stone along that path. Could you talk a little bit more about what that composition of the Southern political elites becomes after this period, after this 1872 amnesty, when we now have this, you know, set of guys coming back into office in the all across the South who had actively supported the Confederacy during the Civil War.
Yeah, so like you said, the Amnesty Act was not like the thing that changed the makeup of the electorate in the South, but it was a factor of who was allowed to run for office, and in some Southern states, who was allowed to legally vote. It was one of many things that kind of changed the conversation. One example, just to bring it back to Alabama, just because that's most of what I know about, there's this article from Wayne Flint. He's a great Alabama historian. He wrote an article about the 1901 Constitution that gives a little bit of background to Alabama's 1875 Constitution. So they had a Constitution in between that 1868 Reconstruction one and the 1901 Constitution that we still use to this day. The 1875 Constitution overturned that more racially progressive 1868 Reconstruction Constitution. And it did a lot of other stuff, like the 1868 Constitution included a lot of necessary bureaucracy and funding for state education. There was kind of a low tax movement that was part of a lot of this opposition to Reconstruction. And this it allowed a coalition of conservatives across the spectrum of, you know, people who later would become populists, even supported this 1875 Constitution just because they saw that it restricted the power of government. But something that's very important about that convention that passed that 1875 Constitution, it was a white convention by a solid majority. There were only a few black delegates to this constitutional convention. In 1868, it was a lot more equitable. Keep in mind, this is before the Great Migration happened. Alabama at this time period is about 45% African American. So a convention that is like 90% white, which is about what it was, is not representative of the entire state. And this 1875 Constitution was able to be passed because they had just had elections in 1874. And this returned all of those former secessionist Democrats back into power, the so-called redemption, the redeemers. These were the people that were going to redeem the South and bring it back from Republican rule. And that 1874 election, like a lot of elections in the South at the time, was marred by violence against black voters. The most notable instance of that in Alabama was the Eufaula Massacre. This is where a group of vigilantes aligned with the White League attacked a large crowd of black voters who were attempting to vote. There is some eyewitness evidence that placed future Governor B.B. Comer as one of, if not one of the gunmen, then one of the people who led the attack.
I think it's interesting as well. You know, we have some familiarity in the narrative, or at least in Northern education we do, about the violence associated with this period and this very violent redeemer reaction here. But the timing, again, seems noteworthy here, that sort of pivot point in 1874, 1875 is happening not that long after this amnesty, because, as you say, this is when these openly secessionist white Democrats can come back into office holding all across the South all at once. Not the case before. There were white politicians, but they were unionists generally, or at least had been during the war. And now all of a sudden, all of these openly secessionist guys are coming back into power. And I think probably in many cases were new, a new generation of office holders, because the older guys who had held office previously, and then seceded, they still weren't amnestied out. So we have this much sort of, I'm guessing, younger set of very hostile anti-Reconstruction, anti-Northern, anti-U.S. military people that are suddenly taking office. And that, I think, is also critical in paving the way for the withdrawal of troops and the ultimate compromise of 1877, putting the final, you know, line underneath that period, is saying, hey, you know, this is untenable now with the situation now that we've allowed all these secessionists back into power there.
Yeah, and for the most part, that is true. For a short period during Reconstruction, a lot of the white people who held office were, you know, these were Southern Unionists, maybe not necessarily all of that, all that progressive on a lot of racial civil rights issues, or they were for the first time like federal and state office holders who were Black. But that wasn't really happening after, you know, the other guys were the open secessionists were allowed back in the door. Once they took power, they were not able to completely disenfranchise Black voters in most states until the late 1890s, when they would rewrite their state constitutions and kind of get the go-ahead from the Supreme Court to do that. But they were back in power.
There were a few exceptions to this, though, this tendency, right? There were definitely some Confederate officers of, and soldiers of various prominences who, once they were allowed back into office, were actually not, you know, not in alignment with the broader trend among their fellow secessionists politically, right?
Yeah, there is a weird, there are a few very notable examples of people who went the other direction politically. Probably the, one of the most successful examples is the Readjuster Party in Virginia. So the Readjuster Party was set up to readjust the state of Virginia's pre-war debt. And there's an article about this that we can link to. But essentially, they had this huge debt that was dragging down the state. But the financing of that debt made a few people a lot of money. The readjusters realized what was going on. They wanted to refinance that debt so that they could pay for public schools throughout the state. Now, this party was led by a guy named General William Mahone. Mahone was a major general in the Confederacy. He fought for the Confederacy at the Battle of the Crater, and he was an opponent of Reconstruction initially, just kind of the classic secessionist conservative guy. But he got into this readjustment movement to readjust the debt and formed a coalition of working class whites and African Americans, because that money was going to the public schools, which were still segregated, but it was going to go to the white schools and the Black schools as well. And he made very clear that he was going to give money to areas of the state that were majority African American. And he won the support of the Black community in Virginia, despite being a former Confederate general, and would end up becoming a senator under the Readjuster Party. His candidate for governor in 1881 was a guy named William Cameron. He entered into a deal with the Black-led section of the state's Republican Party. They endorsed him, and in return, the readjusters, after they won the governor, made a lot of investments into Black schools and eliminated the poll tax. Another example of this is Reuben Kolb of Alabama, who I talked about on my episode. He was a two-time gubernatorial candidate for the Populists in the 1890s, and he was a leader in the Farmers Alliance. He had also been a Confederate artillery captain. Now, he campaigned on eliminating the racist convict lease system. This is where private companies could lease out almost entirely, these were African Americans, people who had been put in prison on usually trumped-up charges, and they would be sold to private companies to usually in the coal mines. He wanted to end this practice and had an alliance with labor because this drove down their wages. But his commitment to this cause was actually pretty shaky, and he would later rejoin the regular Democrats about a decade later and serve in an openly racist state government. But at the time, he was actively challenging the Bourbon Democrats with some African-American supporters. Did you want to talk about Longstreet or...
Yeah, well, I was just going to add, I mean, he's in a slightly different category because he never held office except for being eventually the ambassador from the U.S. to the Ottoman Empire. And he also did not get amnestied in the 1872 amnesty because he did not meet the criteria as a defector from the U.S. Military Officer Corps. to the Confederacy, I believe. But Confederate General James Longstreet, this is just, I'll use the Wikipedia thing as it's a fairly concise summary. Longstreet enjoyed a successful post-war career working for the U.S. government as a diplomat, civil servant, and administrator. His support for the Republican Party and his cooperation with his old friend, President Ulysses S. Grant, as well as critical comments he wrote about Lee's wartime performance, made him anathema to many of his former Confederate colleagues. His reputation in the South further suffered when he led African-American militia against the anti-Reconstruction White League at the Battle of Liberty Place in 1874. Author of the Lost Cause movement focused on Longstreet's action at Gettysburg as a principal reason for why the South, I should say supposedly, lost the Civil War. Again, that's from just the Wikipedia page on James Longstreet, but he's always an interesting figure because he was one of the sort of few very prominent Confederate officers who became kind of a radical-ish Republican after the war. And so it's just kind of interesting to talk about some of these exceptions, like the guys you mentioned, Mahoney and Reuben Kolb and so forth, that there were some outliers there. But in general, it broke down along pretty clear lines that if you had been a secessionist during the war, you were going to support the Redeemer faction after your political rights were restored. In whether it was you were in the 1865 amnesty under Johnson, the 1872 amnesty under Grant, or ultimately some of the later ones that bring everyone back in. Did you have any other closing thoughts or any stray observations about this topic?
You know, reading into it and going back to research that early 1870s era, I was just really struck by, I knew this, like I knew that the Northern public had pretty much given up on black civil rights in the South by the 1870s. But I was shocked just to see, you know, some of the people that had, you know, gone into this liberal Republican movement and to back general amnesty. You know, I had completely forgot that Charles Sumner backed Horace Greeley's campaign against Grant, for instance. And just to see things like that, it's pretty shocking that, like, wow, they gave this up real quick. and it really did just become about the money for some people. I believe Carl Schurz got involved in a lot of that, you know, converting the South's plantation economy into a modern, like, agribusiness. And that just completely overshadowed any of the social revolution that was supposed to happen in the South after this bloody, extremely bloody civil conflict. It's really hard not to be a little disheartened by reading all that about how quickly and easily a lot of these prominent figures gave up.
Right. I mean, it dissipates so quickly after all of that enormous blood that goes into not only winning the Civil War, but gradually converting public opinion to the idea that we needed to do something different and do something radical and drastic. And then for that to dissipate. And especially for it to dissipate after that period in 1870-71, where there's an actual, very serious and militarily backed attempt to do this, to put some real muscle behind it, and they just kind of give up after that. And of course, as we've said several times throughout this episode, a lot of that really has to do with what your orientation to and relationship to major capital formations was at the time. That's really the thing that, you know, people were quite literally willing to sell out these black folks that in many cases, some of them had not been, you know, particularly woke, so to speak, before or even during the Civil War on black people. And their anti-slavery was not necessarily motivated by the most enlightened understanding of the population that they were supposed to be helping. But many of them had come around to the right position and understanding over the course of the war, or, you know, just after the war. And then for them to just kind of give it up, I mean, it is, like you said, it's so disheartening. But I think you and I both learned a bunch more about this topic by focusing in on this Amnesty Act from May of 1872, 150 years ago this month. Patrick, before we close out, I mentioned at the top of the show, Conspiracy You Can Believe In, your podcast that you occasionally release some episodes on, real deep dives, not only on a particular conspiracy, but then you usually do a companion episode around the topic if there's more material to help people better understand it. Where can people get a hold of that and keep up with your work?
Yeah, so I publish the podcast on pretty much any place that you get podcasts. If you look for Conspiracy You Can Believe In on Spotify, Apple, I publish on Anchor. So you can find me at anchor.fm/conspiracy-believe-in, or you can just find me on Twitter at @conspiracy_YCBI.
Yeah, and as usual, I'll put links to that in the show notes that'll be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a subject that, you know, I'm very interested in, but I find like I learn new things about it every time I look at it. Not always great things, but it, Reconstruction is just, it's so undertaught, I feel like, in American schools and just in the general American knowledge of what happened in our country. So any opportunity to dig more into that, I certainly appreciate.